T. Henderson. Judge Welch of the Court of Appeals will be joining the court on this case. Mr. Pivovar, good morning to you. Let's give Judge Welch time to be seated. And we have some folks maybe still coming in the back of the courtroom. Maybe not. Yes, indeed we do. So now you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, counsel. My name's Greg Pivovar, and I'm a court-appointed counsel on the appeal of this matter from the District Court of Douglas County, Nebraska. Tillman Henderson was convicted of first-degree murder of Matthew Voss and attempted first-degree murder of Antonio Washington. This was an incident, and I'm sorry, my voice is going. This was an incident that happened in downtown Omaha and a shooting outside of after-hours bar, basically. This court heard the case in 2014 at 289 Nebraska 271. You affirmed the conviction of Mr. Henderson. He then appealed for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. That was denied in 2015. He filed this post-conviction action alleging ineffective assistance of counsel on his own. The matter was submitted to the court in Douglas County without him having been appointed counsel, and the court basically, summing up the decision, indicated that while he had drawn perhaps factual allegations that may have entitled him to a evidentiary hearing in this matter, he did not allege prejudice on any of those particular factual allegations. While admitting that his petition for post-conviction relief may have been inartfully drawn, as many of them that come from the penitentiary and which are done by the clients themselves are, I think my argument basically to that has to be that some of the prejudice was so obvious. And I'll go into the first one. His first petition was basically that three eyewitnesses that were known to counsel, that he made counsel aware of, were not called at the time of trial. First one was Tim Washington, who was a witness who would have impeached the testimony of the state's main witness, one of the state's main witnesses, Mr. Petrios. Mr. Washington had allegedly observed Mr. Henderson's demeanor and what happened with Mr. Henderson right around the time of the shooting.
What would Mr. Washington have testified to, or what is it alleged that he had testified to?
According to the petitioner's drafting, Mr. Washington would have testified that he saw Tillman Henderson, and Tillman Henderson, in stark contrast to what Mr. Petrios had said, had a calm demeanor at the time of shooting and would have and was not running away from the scene at that time. Mr. Petrios had testified to an incident where allegedly a gun had been handed to Mr. Henderson, and that Mr. Henderson was nervous and was very agitated. Second witness was Deonta Marion, who described in stark contrast to the Mr. Henderson was apprehended the night of the incident, a distance away from the shooting. He had a tan Carhartt jacket on, which a couple, some of the witnesses at trial had identified as the person in the Carhartt jacket being involved in the shooting. Now, Mr. Marion, in stark contrast, had indicated that he saw the two shooters clearly. There were allegedly two shooters. The one of them that had a light-colored short-sleeve shirt on, and the other one had dark-colored clothing on. Neither of which describes a Carhartt jacket.
Was there other evidence in the record of a witness testifying to the shooters wearing something other than the tan Carhartt jacket?
There was a witness, and I'm not sure whether that witness was right at the scene or across the street, that was Charles Byrd, and he gave testimony that, again, that he testified at trial, and he gave testimony that basically did not include the Carhartt jacket as...
Would Mr. Marion's testimony, as Henderson has alleged he would have testified, would that have agreed with the testimony of Charles Byrd, or would it have been different than the testimony of Charles Byrd?
It would have been substantially similar, as I recall. I believe Mr. Byrd's testimony was, again, that he saw the shooters, and one of them had a... lighter colored hoodie on, again, not a Carhartt jacket, and that I believe Mr. Byrd's testimony was also that the other shooter had dark clothing on. So Mr. Marion's testimony would have been corroborative of Mr. Byrd's testimony and in direct opposition to some of the other testimony that was coming out.
Did Mr. Henderson's counsel at trial argue that Mr. Byrd's testimony supported the notion that the shooter had to have been someone else because he identified someone that wasn't wearing the jacket?
He did argue that at trial, and I guess the position that Mr. Henderson would take now is that that the corroborativeness of Mr. Marion's testimony may have been enough to swing reasonable doubt towards Mr. Henderson's position. The third witness was just Jeremy Westbrook. He was the person who gave a 911 call that evening. What he would have testified to is that he was following a vehicle that the shooters got into. And I'll apologize, I don't remember whether it was shooter or shooters. But at least one of the shooters who got into that vehicle, and it was a white SUV, and that he was involved in following that.
Doesn't it make a difference if it was shooters or shooter?
Well, from the other testimony, I believe it may well have made some difference, because obviously if there were two shooters and only one got in the vehicle, Mr. Henderson could have been one of the other two shooters. So, you know, in that regard, whether one or two were involved is probably of some relevance. But I guess when you get into the prejudice prong, while not artfully drawn, again, when you look at that testimony, it's pretty obvious where he's going with the prejudice in that particular manner. He's going to the fact that these were three eyewitnesses to the event. They all had what he believed to be substantial testimony in his favor, or at least to call into serious question the testimony that the state had provided. And the prejudice was that he was denied his right to confront those witnesses, impeach those witnesses, and a fair trial. Again, when we deal with these post-convictions that come from the defendants themselves, and I know they don't get a break because they have to draw it themselves, but they are sometimes inartfully drawn, but the implication is clearly there as to what they're alleging the prejudice is. And we could agree. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appellee of the State of Nebraska. The state maintains that Henderson's post-conviction motion was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing. Normally, I try to follow suit and address the same claims as the appellant. Here, I think as far as the claim about failing to call these witnesses, I think my brief has adequately addressed those issues, and I think Justice Babbitt's questions hit all the same points I made in brief. So I don't think I really have any additional comments on that claim unless the court has questions.
I have a question about Deontay Marion.
Sure.
So opposing counsel's argument seems to be that Mr. Marion's testimony would have corroborated the testimony of Charles Byrd. Why is that incorrect?
Well, I don't know if it would have fully corroborated it. Per the allegations, Deontay Marion would have said that one of them had on a white or light-colored short-sleeve shirt, whereas Mr. Byrd said that I think it was a white or lighter-colored hoodie and then a darker-colored hoodie. So, it would have been somewhat similar. I don't know if it would have fully corroborated it, but to the extent it would have corroborated, I think it would have just been more of the same. The issue was presented at trial. Byrd's testimony was clearly impartial. He had a good view of it. The issue was pitched by counsel. That created a reasonable doubt, and the jury wasn't persuaded. So I just don't think that claim warrants an evidentiary hearing, in our view. If there's no further questions on that, there are three other claims I will briefly address that I think may be more pertinent. First one is trial counsel's failure to request a jury instruction on the lesser included offense of attempted second-degree murder. Second one, appellate counsel's failure to appeal from the denial of a limiting instruction on the text messages. And the third one is appellate counsel's failure to argue that the state waived the good faith exception regarding the search of the cell phone. As far as the first issue regarding trial counsel's failure to request an instruction on the lesser included offense for attempted first-degree murder, we maintain that Henderson's post-conviction motion has not set forth sufficient allegations on this claim since he has not set forth, or his motion has not set forth, which lesser included offense or offenses should have been requested, let alone that there's a reasonable probability that this trial would have been different if those instructions had been requested and given. But in any event, we would submit he can't show prejudice on this claim because the transcript from direct appeal reflects that the trial court did in fact instruct the jury on attempted second-degree murder and gave the appropriate step instruction for limiting instructions per NJI 3.1, which properly instructed the jury to first consider attempted first-degree murder and stop if it found Mr. Henderson guilty, which the jury obviously did. So it never got to the offense of attempted second-degree murder, and of course never would have gotten to attempted sudden quarrel manslaughter either, even if that had been requested and given. So we would submit that the record affirmatively refutes the existence of any prejudice on this claim. Either way, we submit it was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing. As far as the second claim I wanted to address, appellate counsel's failure to appeal from the denial of the limiting instruction regarding the text messages. The limiting instruction in question would have instructed the jury that the text messages should have been considered only for the state of mind, not for the truth of the matter asserted. I set forth in our brief, we believe this claim is without merit, given that this court in State v. Tyler indicated that limiting instructions are not necessarily required when evidence is received over a hearsay objection. We acknowledge that in State v. Schwatter, this court said that it is best practice to give a limiting instruction when receiving evidence over a hearsay objection, but I think Tyler indicates that this is not necessarily required, especially when, as Tyler explains, an appellate court can affirm the admission of evidence over a hearsay objection on a different basis than that relied upon by the trial court. I think this would, the implication there would be that a limiting instruction is not necessarily required. If that's true, we would maintain that this claims without merit is not a sufficient allegation of deficient performance. In any event, we submit
a breach of prejudice. In that it would have gone to state of mind.
I'm sorry?
That the limiting instruction pertained to state of mind.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
that would be another analysis, the alternative analysis for admission.
Right. That was the basis for admission.
Right.
Right. And they sought a limiting instruction to that effect. It was not given. It was denied.
Right.
And so he's claiming that instruction needed to have been given, and it would have appropriately limited the effect of the text messages, which takes me to the prejudice argument. I don't think he can show prejudice on that, because even if that instruction had been given, there's not a reasonable probability that the result would have been different here. The evidence overwhelmingly showed that Henderson participated in this, or was involved in this shooting, as evidenced by, among other things, I mean, witnesses pointed out to police he was one of the shooters as he's fleeing. He had both the guns in question. DNA evidence has ties him to the, has the victim's blood on his clothes. The only thing that these text messages really showed or added to the equation here was that the shooting was premeditated, but the limiting instruction requested would not have limited that aspect of the text messages. The limiting instruction or the limiting instruction itself would have told the jury that you consider this only for statement of mind. So it, even if it had been given, it would have allowed them to consider those text messages for the very purpose.
Would you say it was warranted by the evidence? A limiting instruction would have been warranted by the evidence, or was not even warranted?
So I think that depends on how you reconcile Tyler and Schwatter.
Right.
Schwatter says it is best practice, so if the evidence warrants it, I mean, the basis for which it came in was state of mind, and that's what this court found on direct appeal. If this court is going to say that it should happen per Schwatter, then yes.
Thank you.
But in any event, we would submit that no prejudice exists here, so it was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing. Just briefly on the third and final issue, I don't know much to say on that, but we do maintain, as far as the claim that the state waived the good faith exception by not raising it at the trial level under State v. Tompkins, as I mentioned yesterday, we disagree with the notion that the good faith exception is subject to a waiver at the trial or appellate level.
In this case, did the state raise it at the trial level?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. If they mentioned it briefly in passing through all of these suppression hearings, I'm not aware of it, but from looking over everything, I don't believe they did.
Did the parties brief the suppression issues? Did they submit written briefs? Can we discern that from the record?
There are some, in the transcript from direct appeal, yes, there were some of the briefs submitted regarding the issue. I went through those yesterday. I didn't read word by word, but from what I read and looked through, I did not see any indication that the state had raised the issue. So I think that does put Tompkins squarely before the court in terms of what are we going to do with it, or is it distinguishable? We obviously disagree with it to the extent the court is inclined to revisit it. We would respectfully submit it's incorrect. It should be overruled, but in any event, if this court's not inclined to do so, for purposes of this case, we would submit that it has no application. It obviously applies only if the state does not raise it on direct appeal. We did. This court relied on good faith. So we think that it is distinguishable and inapplicable here. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Mr. Pivot.